You're listening to the Body Pros podcast coverage of AIDS 2008, the 17th International AIDS Conference. The conference took place in Mexico City from August 3rd through August 8th, 2008.
Hi, this is David Wohl from the University of North Carolina. I'm talking to you from Mexico City, where the International AIDS Conference is being convened. The conference is wrapping up now, and during the last week, we've heard a lot of presentations from all over the world. People come together at this conference for many reasons. There's people who are interested in treatment. There are people here who are interested in community advocacy. There are politicians. It's clearly the most important get-together dedicated to the epidemic that occurs on any regular basis. For me as a clinician, I think it's challenging to identify pieces of information that I could take back and use in my practice. Partly that's because this conference is just so massive. As I said, there are people who come from all over the world to share their experiences, and finding the tidbits that are relevant to your own particular practice can be challenging in the midst of all of that. However, this is also an opportunity to learn about life in other parts of the world and also understand how different people approach the epidemic, whether it be from a prevention standpoint or a therapeutic standpoint or an advocacy standpoint. I think what I'd like to do is highlight what was really relevant for me, thinking mostly about what I will take home in my practice, how I will use what I learn here in my clinic, and hopefully convey some information to you that you can also use to help your patients and your management of people living with HIV infection. The topic I think that gets the most attention amongst the clinicians are the treatment trials, and there were several major treatment trials that were discussed here in Mexico City. I think one of the biggest headlines here has been the abacavir story. And that's because there are at least 2 to 3 major clinical studies that have examined the potency and the safety of abacavir over the last year. And updates to this information was presented here. I think arguably one of the most important studies discussed here at Mexico City was AIDS Clinical Trials Group Study 5202. This is a very large treatment trial of over 1,800 individuals that's ongoing right now. The study is attempting to address what's the best medication to start with when treating HIV infection. It's somewhat complicated in its study design. There are 4 different study arms. Half the people are randomized to receive tenofovir and FTC. The other half are randomized to receive abacavir and 3TC. In addition, there's a second randomization to efavirenz or atazanavir-ritonavir. People are blinded as to whether or not they're on tenofovir and FTC or abacavir and 3TC. They do know whether or not they're on efavirenz or atazanavir-ritonavir. The study is for treatment-naive patients. These are people who are 16 years of age or older and have a detectable viral load over 1,000 copies per mil. People could have any CD4 cell count. As many people are aware, in January of this year, a data and safety monitoring board reviewed the data as part of their routine procedures and found that there was concerning information regarding tenofovir and FTC and abacavir 3TC as far as potency of abacavir. What the DSMB at that time recommended to the study team was that there should be unblinding of the study for those with a viral load over 100,000 when they started the trial. It was within this stratum that there was a difference between abacavir and tenofovir as far as viral load suppression. People were unblinded to their assignment to nucleosides and were able to decide whether or not to continue on their assignment or switch to an alternative. For those who started the study with a viral load under 100,000 copies per mil, they remained blinded to their NRTI treatment assignment. What we heard from today were the first official presentation of the data that the DSMB reviewed. The study enrolled from 2005 to 2007. The follow-up is planned for 96 weeks after the last person is enrolled, so that should be the fall of 2009. Interesting points that have to be made about this study are the way that the study was designed and the endpoints that the study uses. For efficacy, the time to virologic failure is used, and somewhat uniquely in this ACTG trial, the failure is broken up into 2 different categories. There's early failure and later failure. Early failure occurs between weeks 16 and 24 when there's a confirmed viral load of 100,000 copies per mil or greater. Later failure is 24 weeks and on when there's confirmed virologic failure as evidenced by a viral load of 200 copies per mil or greater. In addition, another co-endpoint is safety and the time to first grade 3 or 4 sign or symptom or lab abnormality that's at least one grade higher than baseline is used. Tolerability is also assessed, and that's the time to the modification of the original assignment that the person received. The results that were presented at this conference only deal with the people who started the study with 100,000 viral load or greater, and that's 797 people, and they had a median follow-up of 60 weeks. This cohort is very representative of those who are starting therapy nowadays. They had a fairly high viral load and a low CD4 cell count under 200. A quarter of the patients already had a history of AIDS. Importantly, genotype resistance testing was not mandated by the study at the time it was designed, so genotypes were not required. However, about half the patients in the study did have genotypic resistance data available, and that was performed just as part of standard of care at the clinical sites they were enrolled in. The major motivation for the unblinding of the higher viral load stratum was that the time to virologic failure was shorter for those assigned to a Bacavir 3TC compared to tenofovir and FTC. So there were 57 virologic events that occurred in the Abacavir arm compared to 26 in the tenofovir FTC arm. And this was highly significant with a p-value of 0.003. When you look at the timing of virologic failure, there was clearly excess virologic failure, whether you're talking about early failure or later failure. In addition, even when you look at people who had over 200 at 24 weeks or beyond who previously had a prior viral load less than 200, there were more persons in the Abacavir 3TC arm who experienced virologic failure compared to tenofovir and FTC. Reassuringly, those who achieved a viral load less than 50 copies per mil confirmed did not experience virologic rebound on Abacavir to any greater extent than what was seen with tenofovir. In addition, the time to regimen completion, that means time to first virologic failure or the first time that the nucleosides had to be modified, again, was shorter for those assigned to Abacavir and 3TC with 114 events in that group of patients compared to 68 events in the tenofovir FTC arms. Again, highly significant with a p-value of 0.001. A secondary analysis looked at the intent to treat proportion of those with less than 50 copies per mil out to 96 weeks. And importantly, I think when looking at these data, one has to appreciate that in this intent to treat analysis, switch does not equal failure, such that if you switched from Abacavir to tenofovir, you're still considered in the Abacavir group. So when this was presented and looking at the week 48 data, we didn't see differences between Abacavir and tenofovir in the proportion of people less than 50 at week 48. I think this is a confusing point for most people because at week 48, even if 98% of people on Abacavir had already switched to tenofovir, they'd still be considered Abacavir assigned patients. But I think it's really important that people look at this very carefully, and when looking at the secondary analysis of the proportion of people less than 50 at week 48, have to recognize that a significant proportion of people in Abacavir arm were no longer on Abacavir. That's an important point that I think sometimes gets missed. There was concern that perhaps the Abacavir hypersensitivity reaction that would, of course, occur with Abacavir in some proportion of patients might have been driving the shorter time to virologic failure or regimen completion, and that does not seem to be the case. Fortunately, there were not very many suspected drug hypersensitivity reactions, and actually there was an identical number in each of the study groups. Thus, 27 people were suspected of having drug hypersensitivity reaction to Abacavir in the Abacavir group, and 27 people in the tenofovir assigned groups also had a suspected HSR. Thus, it doesn't seem like this was a major concern. Importantly, screening with HLA-B5701 was not required in this study. When looking at safety endpoints, also there was a difference, and it did not favor Abacavir. There seemed to be more adverse events in general. Again, this is not driven by Abacavir hypersensitivity reaction, what we see is just a variety of different aches and pains that seem to be more concentrated in the back of your group. So I think the important take-home messages from this important study are that when looking at potency and perhaps safety, we see that there is a difference between abacavir and tenofovir in people who start with a very high viral load. I think that the unique ways in which the AIDS Clinical Trials Group chooses their endpoints, I don't think detracts from the differences that are being seen in this very large study. I think that those who quibble with the choice of ACTG endpoints have to recognize that there is a valid reason why these are chosen. Oftentimes, the ACTG will not use a less than 50 outcome because of the variability in the assay that's just inherent in that assay, and also so not to get fooled by blips. Thus, often what you'll see is less than 200 copies used as a cutoff, as it was in the later failures in this trial. But I think it's important to recognize that these data are robust. There are over 780 people involved in this analysis, and thus I think it's hard to refute. And as we'll talk about in a few minutes, there are those who have questioned these results, but I do think personally that they are real and that we have to have some appreciation for these differences when we're treating our patients. There are some caveats, of course. We don't understand yet the baseline resistance patterns, as resistance testing wasn't mandated as part of the study. Thus, if there was, for some reason, a disproportionate number of individuals who had baseline resistance that would confer decreased susceptibility to abacavir, that might explain some of this difference. But again, we didn't apparently see this type of difference in people with lower viral loads at baseline, so I'm not sure how that would pan out, but that's something that I think is important to look at. As we'll talk about, I think clinicians and patients are going to have to think hard about the role of abacavir given these results, and especially given other data that tried to refute this. There was another study called the HEAT study, H-E-A-T, that was sponsored by the makers of abacavir. In that study, which was much smaller in size, again, tenofovir and FTC were pitted against abacavir and 3TC. This time, everyone got lopinavir or ritonavir. In that study, there wasn't difference in potency seen, whether in people with a high viral load or a low viral load. Again, that study was smaller and had lopinavir or ritonavir on board, and perhaps that boosted PI was able to overcome any differences or mask any differences between the nucleoside selections. What was interesting during this conference, and I think sort of permeated at least the treatment aspect of this meeting, was this sort of he said sort of back and forth between the ACTG study team and investigators from the manufacturer of abacavir. Clearly, they have good reason to be somewhat defensive given recent findings regarding abacavir. And so on the heels of the presentation of the ACTG data was a presentation from the makers of abacavir spelling out their experience with the drug in their treatment trials. And what they did, I think, was clever and very necessary. They went back into their database and looked at clinical trials of abacavir. And what they tried to do was apply the same endpoint analysis that was utilized in the ACTG study to their data. And what they wanted to answer was whether or not abacavir and 3TC was less effective in patients who had a viral load greater than 100,000 in a review of six different trials, and also looking at the HEAT data that I mentioned previously. The six different trials used different companion drugs. In some of the trials, efavirenz was used. In one trial, atazanavir or ritonavir was used, similar to ACTG 5202, but in others, lopinavir, ritonavir, or fosaprenavir were the third companion drugs. In addition, abacavir in some of these trials was used once a day, as it was in ACTG 5202. In others, it was twice a day. The bottom line from their presentation was that across different treatment trials, the virologic suppression rate using the ACTG 5202 endpoints was very, very, very high, over 92% across the studies. And there didn't seem to be any difference at all between those who started with a higher viral load, over 100,000, versus those with a viral load under 100,000. In fact, typically in these studies, the difference between the two viral load strata were separated only by 1 or 2 percentage points as far as the proportion of people getting undetectable or having virologic success. Likewise, the analysis highlighted the results from the HEAT study, where again, there was no major difference between those above 100,000 and below 100,000, and abacavir 3TC and tenofovir FDC seemed to be very equivalent. So what do we make of these data? Well, of course, I think there's two different analyses that we're asked to look at. One is a very large randomized clinical trial. The other is analysis of pooled data from different clinical trials. I think that we have to look closely at the populations. There are clearly going to be differences between the populations enrolled in one very recent trial versus the disparate populations enrolled over a longer period of time in different treatment trials sponsored by the manufacturer of abacavir. I think that we'd want to understand more, and this came up in the question and answer period, about the population vis-a-vis the gender makeup, the racial makeup, CD4 cell count, viral load, etc., and whether or not this could have influenced some of the differences we're seeing between these two analyses. I think for myself, the cleaner way of approaching this is the way that the ACTG study, of course, is doing things. It's a prospective randomized trial, and we have infinite respect for that study design. I could certainly understand the motivation for looking back at previously collected data and studies that were conducted by the manufacturer, but I think it's going to be difficult to override the findings of a large ACTG study. For me, in my clinical practice, I think that the use of abacavir and 3TC as an initial regimen is really an alternative, especially for people with higher viral loads at this point. We still have a lot to learn from ACTG 5202. Much of what we understand now are what were released by the DSMB, the Data Safety Monitoring Board. There's still a lot more data. We don't fully understand yet the influence of efavirenz versus atazanavir or ritonavir as a companion drug on the potency of these two different nucleoside combinations. But I think caution is probably wise at this point. Plus, I think that the attractiveness of tenofovir and FTC as a combination, a fixed-dose combination, is really hard to beat. And so I think at this point, one has to ask themselves, what would be the reason that you would use abacavir and 3TC, especially in persons with higher viral loads, given the data that we're seeing here? And as I think anyone who looks at the images that emerged from ACTG 5202, the differences between the two nucleoside combinations is not subtle. And I think that it really does give pause to enthusiastic use of abacavir, especially, again, in patients like those that were studied in the ACTG 5202 analysis. That said, I think it's important that abacavir continue to be available, of course, and I think it's a good thing that abacavir is there for people who cannot or will not take tenofovir for whatever reason. But again, I think, as we'll talk about with analyses of the safety of abacavir, I think we have to be open-minded to the possibility that this drug is less potent and perhaps less safe than tenofovir. A question that comes up all the time, though, is what do I do with my patient who already started on abacavir and is doing well? I think that this is a difficult point, and it's something we have to come back to after we discuss the data from the DAD study and the SMART study. And we'll talk about those in a few minutes. But I think for most people, if the patient is doing well, there's a real reluctance to try to change their therapy. But I think it's important and necessary that we have a conversation with these patients about the data. And I don't think we have to go into great detail, but I think they should be aware that there is an indication that there are alternative drugs, in this case, tenofovir FTC, that might be more potent if their viral load was over 100,000 when they started therapy. In addition, there may be questions about the longer-term tolerability and safety of abacavir, especially when it comes to cardiovascular disease. So I think this is a conversation that our patients need to have. For patients at low risk for the tolerability problems we're talking about and have already proven themselves by doing fantastically well virologically on abacavir, there's less motivation to change. The discussion should still be had. But the back of your story continues. That is not the whole deal. And it does seem like every other presentation here of interest had to do with the back of ear. And I think that in some way is unfortunate because it may detract from other studies that were presented here that also merit some discussion. Most people should appreciate by now that a study called the DAD study, a very large collection of observational cohort studies, found and has now published in The Lancet an association between a back of ear and myocardial infarction. There was about a 90% increased risk of myocardial infarction among those who are recently treated with a back of ear compared to those treated with other nucleosides. Again, in sort of a necessary but somewhat defensive posture, the makers of a back of ear have presented data to try to put into context some of the findings from that study. Again, the company has gone back to their collected data to try to understand further whether or not there is an association between their drug and the outcomes that were described in the DAD study. In this case, what they did was they went back to their repository and looked at 54 clinical trials. This included 13 studies of adults who were randomized to a back of ear versus a control, 33 trials that included a back of ear in the background regimen, and 8 trials that did not include a back of ear at all. This includes data from over 14,600 subjects with over 12,000 person years of follow-up. Importantly, almost all of these were adults, but 500 of these were children. What they did was look back at their data and look for any report or description of coronary artery disorders or ischemic coronary artery disorders. And specific terms included coronary artery disease or acute MI, angina. These were terms that they were able to search within their database of collected data from these trials. Importantly, these were trials that involved treatment-naive patients as well as those who were treatment-experienced. And the bottom line is they looked really hard, and fortunately, myocardial infarction and ischemic coronary artery disease were pretty rare. The rates were on the order of 2.04 to 2.36 per 1,000 person years when looking at myocardial infarction, and a little bit higher, about 3.5 to 6 per 1,000 person years when looking at the broader category of ischemic coronary artery disease. If anything, there did seem to be a little bit more coronary artery disease in those not receiving a back of ear compared to those who did receive a back of ear. Thus, what they found was there was no significant difference at all between receiving a back of ear and not receiving a back of ear when it came to cardiovascular disease events like MIs or other coronary artery disorders. Of course, I think the limitations of such an analysis are pretty obvious. For one thing, all they're able to look at are events that have been reported or detected. There could have been events that did not get reported. There's also a short duration of follow-up compared to a longer observational cohort. And I think that there could be other biases, of course, of patients who are enrolled in these clinical trials. That's a very different population than a large group that was studied in DAD, over 30,000 patients, and followed longitudinally. However, I think that these data are somewhat reassuring and, in my opinion, indicate that we're talking about a fairly rare event that's made slightly less rare with the use of a back of ear. I think what makes it even harder to refute the DAD findings now was another presentation, this time by the SMART study group. Although the analyses were motivated by the investigators from the DAD cohort to try to validate their findings from that cohort in a very large clinical trial called the SMART study. The SMART study is one of the most important trials that has ever been conducted in the realm of HIV therapy. This is a large clinical trial of over 5,000 individuals who were randomized to continue on their HIV therapy, and most were on HIV therapy when they entered the study, versus stopping their HIV therapy until their CD4 cell count hits 250. Once it did, they would reinitiate their HIV therapy and then stop it again once their CD4 cell count rose to 350 or more. As most people are aware, the study was stopped prematurely due, again, to excess adverse outcomes in those who discontinued their therapy. There were excess events of death and morbidities, including cardiovascular disease, renal disease, and hepatic disease, as well as age-related events What the investigators presenting the data at this conference did was look at those who were on HIV therapy and specifically analyze cardiovascular disease events occurring among those who were receiving abacavir versus those who were not receiving abacavir, so all the others. And when you look at different definitions of cardiovascular disease being more inclusive and a little bit less inclusive and as narrow as just myocardial infarction, the data were pretty consistent in that those who were not on abacavir seemed to be protected versus those who were on abacavir. In other words, those who are on abacavir had greater risk of having cardiovascular disease and myocardial infarction compared to those who were not on abacavir. During the presentation, the presenter, Jens Lundgren, also described results for DDI, and they were not as robust as those from the analyses of abacavir. There did not seem to be as strong a signal, although there certainly was an effect as well for DDI. What wasn't demonstrated but came out later in the question and answer was that tenofovir did not seem to have any problem at all as far as cardiovascular disease or myocardial infarction, in a distinction, of course, to abacavir in this analysis. Importantly, the excess cardiovascular events seemed to be really concentrated in those who had five or more cardiovascular risk factors. In fact, for those who had less risk factors, there wasn't a significant effect of being on abacavir as far as development of cardiovascular disease. These are very consistent data with the DAD study, where those who are at moderate or high risk for cardiovascular disease seem to really have the greatest impact of being on abacavir as far as cardiovascular disease events compared to those who had lower risk for cardiovascular disease. Thus, the DAD data and the SMART data are very complementary, which leads to the question of whether or not there was some overlap in the populations. There was. Individuals in DAD could enroll into the SMART study. However, Dr. Lundgren indicated that over 90% of the individuals who were in the SMART study were not in the DAD cohort, and that analysis excluding those who were and did not change the findings. To try to understand a mechanistic explanation for why abacavir might be associated with cardiovascular disease, there was an analysis of cytokines and inflammation, looking specifically at IL-6. This is a cytokine that had been associated previously in the SMART cohort with adverse outcomes, including mortality. They also looked at high sensitivity CRP, C-reactive protein, as well as D-dimer, amyloid P, and amyloid A. Most significantly was that those on abacavir and not DDI had higher levels of IL-6 compared to the other nucleosides taken as a group, and same thing for high sensitivity CRP. Thus, there may be more inflammation or more cytokine release for some reason that we're seeing in people who are on abacavir compared to those on other nucleosides. So again, in total, where does this leave us? I think this is a difficult situation for us. Abacavir is a nice alternative to tenofovir. Not everyone can take tenofovir. And as we discussed regarding potency, I think we have to be very cautious when using abacavir given these data. Again, there are some caveats and there's some instruction from these studies. In both the SMART study and the DAD study, the risk of cardiovascular disease was much higher among those who received abacavir, but also had higher baseline cardiovascular risk factors. That's the group that I'd be most concerned about using abacavir. That's the group that I'd also be concerned about continuing on abacavir if they're doing well on the drug and they're taking it right now. So I think those patients that I see who have significant risk factors for cardiovascular disease, who are doing well on abacavir, there's a real strong pull to try to talk to those individuals perhaps about switching. However, if those people also have mutable risk factors, such as smoking, things we can change, I think that it's really important to try to act on those as much as we can. If those are not things that we can change, if we can't control their blood pressure better, if we're not going to be able to stop them from smoking, those are the patients that I'm most worried about continuing on abacavir. I think what we still need to understand more of is why this occurs. What's the mechanism behind abacavir's role in cardiovascular disease if this does pan out? It's going to be hard to get much more conclusive data. There are not too many opportunities to look at an association between abacavir and cardiovascular disease in clinical trials. You would need a much larger clinical trial than those that we design now and have to follow people for quite a long time to detect those events. That's not going to happen. There aren't too many observational cohort studies that can actually look at this. Perhaps the Veterans Administration, perhaps some HMO, large collection of patient data can do this. But I don't think we're going to get a whole lot more information that's going to help us understand what's going on here beyond what we have right now, unless we have a mechanism that's demonstrated pathogenically. And so there's a concentration on trying to understand what's going on, how this drug interacts with our immune systems to create cytokines or other inflammatory chemicals that may propagate and promote atherosclerosis. Till that time, again, I think we have to be cautious. And there's enough information now that I think we should make rational and evidence-based choices when selecting antiretroviral therapy and have to be, again, somewhat circumspect about using a back of your first line. For me, this is going to continue to be an alternative to tenofovir. And I don't think that there's going to be much in the way of new data that's going to change that for quite some time, if ever. But it wasn't all just about abacavir in Mexico City. There were other drugs that were worth discussing, and there was some new information that is going to be useful to those of us in the clinic. Raltegravir has become really an exciting new drug that I think many people are looking at for a variety of different situations clinically. And an interest that comes up pretty consistently when we discuss this drug is whether or not it could be used in treatment-naive patients. We have limited data on the use of raltegravir in treatment-naive patients, and there is one protocol from which we get most of these data, if not almost all the data, and that's protocol 004. And this study has been presented previously, and an update to the outcomes in the study were presented here in Mexico City. This was a study of treatment-naive individuals who were randomized to receive raltegravir versus efavirenz in combination with tenofovir and 3TC. Patients had to be demonstrated to be susceptible to efavirenz, tenofovir, and 3TC at baseline and have a viral load over 5,000 copies. They also had to have a CD4 cell count over 100. 24-week and 48-week data had been presented previously, and now we're going to hear about 96-week data. It's a small study. This is not a large clinical trial. 160 people were randomized to raltegravir, 38 to efavirenz. And what we saw early on that was quite remarkable and caused quite a bit of buzz when the data were first presented was that in the different doses of raltegravir that were used in this study, we saw a dramatic decline in viral load compared to efavirenz over the first few weeks of the study. And there was a hope or a promise that perhaps that quick viral load decay that occurred with raltegravir would lead to even more robust and potent virologic outcomes. However, the differences over time between efavirenz and raltegravir dissipated as far as viral suppression, and they continued to be equivalent out to 48 weeks. What we saw here is that they're almost identical even after 96 weeks, with 84% of individuals in both arms, those who received raltegravir versus those who received efavirenz, achieving a viral load less than 400. When you look at those with less than 50 copies, almost identical results to the less than 400, 83% and 84% of individuals getting undetectable. So clearly, this is a drug in this limited study with a limited number of patients, small number of patients, that appears to be as potent or nearly as potent as efavirenz, a drug that is the most potent antiretroviral anchor that we have currently. CD4 cell counts were exactly similar in the two study arms, again, reassuring us that this is going to be a drug that has a future, perhaps, as a therapy for individuals who are treatment naive. There were some failures, of course, in the study, and the good news was we did not see emergence of widespread raltegravir resistance. There's been concern that there's a lower genetic barrier for raltegravir than protease inhibitors, and that resistance can be acquired relatively easily. But again, in this treatment naive study, that was not a major concern. There were some adverse events, and they are notable. What was seen in the study, of course, was the central nervous system problems that are associated with efavirenz, and that was concentrated in the efavirenz arm of the study. However, there were more CPK elevations, elevations of creatine kinase in the raltegravir arm, 6.3% versus 2.6% in efavirenz. 10 individuals had high grade 3 or grade 4 elevation of CPK in the raltegravir arm. And elevations of CPK have also been described in patients receiving raltegravir in the benchmark studies, looking at treatment-experienced patients, and I think is a cause for concern. Elevated lipase also was seen in the treatment studies looking at treatment-experienced patients. And here there was, again, a slight difference between the two arms, although this is a small study, and we should be cautious about overinterpreting two patients in raltegravir getting an elevation of lipase versus none in the efavirenz arm. So in summary, I think that this is an important first step in understanding a role for raltegravir in individuals who are treatment naive. Further studies will emerge that will look at this in a much more rigorous way. Another study that I think is worth mentioning that involves drugs that are approved for HIV therapy is what's being lovingly called the Mexican A5142 study. Now remember, A5142 was a nice study done by the ACTG. It was sort of the 5202 study of its time. It looked at efavirenz versus lopinavir or ritonavir as initial therapy for HIV, and was really a blockbuster of a clinical trial that helped us understand the relative merits and disadvantages of efavirenz versus lopinavir or ritonavir. Well, this is sort of the Mexican version. And what they did was, in a sort of more compact and more limited way, look again at efavirenz versus lopinavir or ritonavir, this time in combination with AZT and 3TC. What they also wanted to do was look at patients with a little bit more advanced disease, those who have a CD4 cell count less than 200. This is a study that, interestingly, enrolled people in different parts of Mexico, including people living in fairly rural areas. So I think it really is an important study, especially here in Mexico and other places where these therapies might be used that are not super cosmopolitan or, let's say, resource rich. Anyhow, the bottom line from this study that I think is interesting is it really confirmed what ACTG 5142 found, namely, A, that efavirenz beats anything that's compared to it. There's no trial that has ever found that there's a therapy so far that has beaten efavirenz head-to-head in treatment-naive patients. And here again, we see that efavirenz had better virologic response rates compared to lopinavir or ritonavir. The good news for lopinavir or ritonavir is that the differences were not significant when looking at less than 400. It was only when looking at less than 50. Thus, maybe some of virologic efficacy deficit was made up of those who had low-level viremia. And again, this was looking at use of soft gel capsules of lopinavir or ritonavir that in many settings is hard to use, especially, I think, in rural Mexico. Nonetheless, CD4 cell count seemed to be higher, was higher, in those who are on lopinavir or ritonavir, just like what we saw in the larger U.S. study. So I think that these data are important in that they validate what was really, if we remember back, a pretty surprising result when the ACTG 5142 study first came out. So I think this is an important piece of data and certainly confirms mostly what we saw in that larger study. As far as studies of new drugs that are not yet approved, I think really the one study that I'd like to highlight is a study of rilpivirine. That's TMC-278. As most people probably remember, this is a new non-nucleoside, and it's a once-a-day non-nucleoside, so it has some hope of perhaps being a new and improved efavirenz. The data that were presented here focused on a dose-ranging clinical trial that was done. It's TMC-278, the C204 study that was sponsored by the manufacturer of this particular compound, and like most other studies, pits itself against efavirenz. There were three different doses of TMC-278, 150 milligram dose, a 75 milligram, and a 25 milligram dose, all compared against efavirenz taken with two nucleosides. All patients were treatment naive. There were 368 of them. All had to have a viral load over 5,000 copies. When looking out to 96 weeks as far as virologic efficacy, getting under 50 copies per mil by an intent to treat Tolover analysis, we see that the differences between the different treatment arms are fairly minimal. Even the lower dose TMC-278 arm, 25 milligrams per day, had a response of 76% compared to the efavirenz arm, which was around 71%. Thus, we're not seeing any big differences between these different study arms, different doses of TMT-278 or efavirenz. And even when looking at pure virologic failure, there weren't any significant differences between the different study arms. of Favran's, there were 6 pure virologic failures by week 48. It was up to 8 at week 96. In the TMC278 groups, the number of failures ranged from 7 to 10 when combining them all together. So I think that, again, we're seeing that this is a potent non-nucleoside in treatment-naive patients. Much of the attention during the presentation focused on the 25 milligram dose. Previous to this conference, it was announced that there were problems with EKG changes among those who were taking TMC278 at the 75 milligram and 150 milligram dose. Thus, the manufacturer of the drug had gone back to look at 25 milligrams and has now launched clinical trials of the drug using the 25 milligram lower dose. That dose was found to be less involved in any changes of the EKG. Specifically for this particular drug, TMC278, prolongation of the QTC interval had been detected during earlier studies. When looking at the 25 milligram dose of TMC278, there were 9 virologic failures. Unfortunately, the presenter didn't detail the resistance mutations that might have developed in these 9 individuals who developed resistance on the 25 milligram dose of 278. In addition, there was some confusion about the adverse events, the way that they were described, and it wasn't clear that all of the particular adverse events associated with TMC278 were accounted for in the presentation. In addition, during this discussion, there was a simple bullet point regarding increases in QTC interval that were seen with TMC278 and with the Favran's. However, there were no data presented, and I think that was unfortunate. Overall, however, I think that this was a positive study that indicated that TMC278, even in the lower dose, seemed to go toe-to-toe with the Favran's, and that further study at the 25 milligram dose of the drug in larger clinical trials was warranted. I think the presentation does leave some gaps in our understanding about the resistance that develops to this drug and also understanding more about the potential toxicity of the agent. And hopefully that will be reconciled in later presentations at other conferences. The last treatment study I want to mention is the GRACE study. And this is a study that I think is pretty important. This is looking at use of antiretrovirals in combination for individuals who are treatment experienced. They don't have to be deeply treatment experienced. It could be a first failure. And specifically, the study is looking at the use of these drugs in women, particularly African-American women. So it's an open label phase 2b trial, and it's designed to assess the sex and race differences in tolerability of darunavir or ritonavir over a year of therapy. At this conference, we got the 24-week interim analysis. This involved 203 patients out of the total of 429 individuals. This study, again, is directed towards trying to understand more about the utility of this drug in combination with others in African Americans and women. Thus, 65% of the persons who are analyzed here are African American, 22% are Latino. The regimen consisted of darunavir ritonavir at 600, 100 milligrams BID, plus an optimized background regimen that could include nucleosides and or non-nucleosides, and you can also be on etravirine. The virologic response of women compared to all patients was presented, and looking at less than 50 copies per mil in an attempt to treat Tolover analysis, found that 50.8% of women achieved virologic suppression below 50 copies compared to 51% of all patients, identical rates of suppression among women receiving the combination. Likewise, we saw an increase in CD4 cell count in women of around 86 compared to 83 in all patients taken in total. Thus, we're seeing similar sorts of responses immunologically from women to the other participants. I think this is a nice analysis, and I think it's a good effort to try to understand better how these drugs work in the populations that are likely to be exposed to them. And so I think that this is reassuring. The overall rate of response of only 50%, that's glass half full, glass half empty. I think this could be a more difficult to treat population. I think that it's hard to compare this group to other studies that had different populations and different success rates. And we'll see what happens as the study progresses. But I think it's a very good first step to understanding that this is totally appropriate therapy for this group and seem to be well tolerated and efficacious. we had a slew of different studies, studies of old drugs, studies of newer drugs, studies of drugs that haven't even come out yet. And what are we to make of all this? And I think at this conference, there was an overlay as well of drama. You had the ACTG 5202 data. You had rebuttals from the manufacturer of the medication. Then on the other hand, you had the DAD data and the SMART data and rebuttals to that information. So, you know, there was all this back and forth, and I think there was concern that, you know, we're at loggerheads here. And I don't think that's the way it is. I think that the system is working. We are doing investigations. We find things. We try to validate them to the best of our ability. That's what research is about. We can't answer every question. I know that's frustrating to our patients. It's frustrating to us as clinicians. People are constantly going to be saying after this conference, well, what am I to do? Well, what I think you need to do, and what we have to tell our patients to understand, is we need to look at the data and make our own decisions. When ACTG 5142 came out, showing that efavirenz was better virologically than lopinavir-ritonavir, but lopinavir-ritonavir was better immunologically than efavirenz, and there was this whole resistance story and this whole lipoatrophy story, there was no bottom line, one easy one-liner take-home message for people to understand. They had to look at the data and decide for themselves what was important. We have to do the same thing with the data we're receiving now. These data will be published soon, very quickly. These analyses were done very rapidly. And what we're going to have to decide is for our individual patient, what is best for them? Should they use abacavir? Should they not use abacavir? Should they use other drugs that are being studied in the different studies that I talked about? Should they not? What's the role of the newer drugs? How much information does it take before it changes your practice? We're all different in that way. And so I think we have to take these messages, digest them, and then translate them into our clinical practices in the way that we think is best for our patients. And that's all a conference can do. And I think this conference, at least from the therapeutic side of it, was successful with the limited number of presentations that were available here. So I think this is good to know. I think each of you should look carefully at the data that were presented here. And again, make your own decisions, and I'm sure that your patients will benefit from that.
The opinions expressed by hosts or interviewees in this podcast do not constitute professional advice, should not be considered substitutes for professional services, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of Body Health Resources Corporation or its sponsors. Please see the full disclaimer online at thebodypro.com. If you have comments or questions, please contact us.
This has been a report on the 17th International AIDS Conference from The Body Pro. For more podcasts and full coverage of this conference, visit us online at thebodypro.com/AIDS2008.